tell me what's happening, what's the buzz? Tell me what's happening, what's the buzz? Tell me what's happening, what's the buzz? Tell me what's happening, what's the buzz?
Welcome to Friday, and welcome to Week in Review. This hour, we're going to learn from the news of the week, and we're going to do it with friends, because we are with a very physically attractive live audience, I'm just noticing, at the Vera Project in Seattle Center. Hi, team. Not that that's everything. You happen to be good-looking, but there's much more to life. Just remember that. This week, the people who opposed densifying Seattle's single-family neighborhoods, they got what they wanted on one front anyway. Seattle's mayor backed off his recommendation of allowing duplexes, triplexes, and row houses, mother-in-laws, and backyard cottages in all single-family zoned neighborhoods. We are joined by the Honorable Ed Murray, Mayor of Seattle. Mayor, thank you for coming.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I know you want to talk about more than just this, but I want to start with the change. You relented on this piece of your affordable housing plan. Why did you change your ways?
The report had 65 recommendations, some changes to single family, not mostly what you read about in the newspaper, but some changes to single family were one of those recommendations, changes that would have looked like what Portland has and Vancouver has. And Portland has great single family neighborhoods, and it works. We weren't talking about building triplexes and duplexes on every single block and every single lot. But anyway, people had fun with that one. So we set it down because the other 65 or 64 are more important, particularly something that housing advocates have wanted for two decades, mandatory inclusionary zoning for affordable housing. Now, affordable housing is not just simply low-income housing. That's market-rate housing that's affordable to people who make very little but work and can't live in this city today. So I set the other down because we were missing where most of the gains would be made in affordable housing. And that's in the mandatory inclusionary part.
Okay, so we'll talk other affordable housing stuff. Before we leave this single family question, the HALA committee, your affordable housing committee,
right,
worked on this for a long, long time. You got a lot of different kinds of people together and then finally went out with this plan. Why make a switch on this idea of densifying single family neighborhoods?
Sure, because it was a fairly marginal densification. And it is a very marginal part of the larger gain we want to make. We are not having the discussion we wanted to have, which is about affordable housing. And most of that affordable housing is in the other recommendations. It's doing mandatory inclusion when we develop housing. It's doubling the housing levy. It's the multifamily tax exemption. It's the preservation policy, offering landlords or building owners the opportunity to get a tax credit if they keep rent stable. Those things are being lost in this discussion, and they create far, far, far more affordable units than this one piece.
We talked a lot this last few weeks about the special character of Seattle, the Seattle that's the reason we're all here. How much of that special character of the city are you asking us to give up, to trade away for, to become a more affordable city?
Well, so I don't think I am. And, you know, we're sitting in the site of the World's Fair. I came here in 1962 when I was seven. I just told you what my age is. But the Seattle I grew up in was a Seattle that believed in fairly, with values that we could have economic diversity in our neighborhoods. This is a city that's always been committed to racial diversity. This is a city that wants to get equity right. And I think we can do those things. I think we can grow and grow affordably and not destroy the character of our neighborhoods. I think we've had a false discussion if we're going to plow down your single-family homes and we're going to ruin your neighborhood business districts. Actually, I think if we can get affordability right in America, we can get it right in Seattle.
You just brought up the idea of race, which has been a controversial discussion in these last few weeks, and you didn't drop the subject when you came out and released the statement saying that you were modifying your position. So if I am suspicious, if I am opposed to losing special character of my single-family neighborhood, whether you think that's valid or not,
right,
am I racist or upholding a racist system?
So where in the HALA report does it say that? Nowhere. Where in my comments in the press conference does it say that? Nowhere.
Well, you said Seattle still needs to, first of all, the HALA report talked about the zoning, single-family zoning, having its roots in a racist and exclusionary system.
Right, absolutely. But that's not calling someone a racist.
Right.
If you look at a map of Seattle in the 1930s, and you look at where people of color and poor people live in this city, and you look at map today of Seattle, and you look at where people of color and poor people live, those maps are identical. And if you take another map and you look at where high school graduation rates are bad, those maps are all identical. We live in one of the most racially divided by neighborhood cities in the West. And we're like number 20 now in population. We're number 60 as far as having integrated neighborhoods. So that's not calling people racist, but we have to have an honest discussion here. And again, I think this is a city, and the people in this city are the right people, and this is the right city to have that discussion. This is a city that's concerned about racial equality.
Here's the, you can call it a conspiracy theory or the Mayor Murray's a brilliant negotiator theory, which is that you never thought this single family little piece of your project was going to happen. You knew people would howl, so then you get to be the reasonable mayor, the mayor who has listened to you, and then get everything else that you wanted anyway.
So, this was my mistake, and I will own this mistake. So it wasn't a strategy, it was a mistake. I thought people would focus on the grand bargain that housing, low-income housing advocates have been working on for 20 years. So where I am now is, so folks who didn't want changes to single family are angry and suspicious of me, and folks who actually believe that if their kids are going to have a place to live, get that starter house, I should not have backed away from single family, they're angry at me. So it was hardly a strategy.
You should have gone for theory that you're brilliant, Ed. I would have stuck with that one.
Let's introduce our panel. That was Rob McKenna, former attorney general, ran for governor as a Republican in this state, and we have other panelists too as well. Any questions or comments on all this, Rob McKenna?
No, I just
a politician just admitted that he made a mistake. By the way, that happened. An earthquake might hit Seattle, but I'm telling you. That just happened.
Mr. Mayor, you're a disgrace to the profession of politicians. This thing about this honesty, owning your mistakes, my God, man, what are you doing?
Well, thank God you're criticizing me, because if you were complimenting me, I'd be in trouble.
Anything I can do to help, Mr. Mayor.
From the stranger, our Pulitzer Prize winner, Associate Editor Eli Sanders. Question for the mayor or reaction?
Well, I do wonder what we can do now to move forward with the idea of making the 65%+ of Seattle that is zoned single family only more accessible to people who, as you said, want those starter homes, want to diversify Seattle, want to decline the segregation that you see when you look at the maps. If we're backing away from the idea of a very modest upzone, which, you know, I think you powerfully supported when the Hala Committee first came out with its decision and correctly described as the solution to Seattle's economic apartheid. Those were your words.
Right.
What can we do now to push forward on ending that economic apartheid and make single-family zones more flexible for development, but not like rising apartment
Sure.
towers?
So
see that? I have three fans here. They're the attractive ones, though, that he was talking about.
Your husband and other people from The Stranger. No, so actually, again, the heart of dealing with that issue that we're not an affordable city, the fact that, you know, I grew up here, I have six siblings, only two of us can afford to live in this city. The trying to address that crisis is actually in the rest of the plan. It is about using our urban villages and our transportation districts and upzoning those about a floor in return for the first time requiring developers to build affordable housing, something that's never happened in this city before. We've depended on the public sector and nonprofits to build our affordable housing. We reach an agreement with developers and low-income housing advocates to actually upzone about a floor in our urban villages and other related areas, and we will actually get more affordable housing than we've ever gotten in the city before.
But then do we continue to draw a line around the single-family zoned areas and say, this is not where we're going to pursue density?
Well, right now I don't believe we can have that conversation. Unfortunately, and this is where my communications director is going to go sideways, unfortunately there was a media frenzy that wasn't based on facts. And if we could go back at some point in the future and have that discussion and get people comfortable with the idea that we might put, you know, some of those cottages, some folks might put cottages in some blocks, that would actually create more affordable units for probably their own children who aren't going to be able to afford to live in the city, then I think we can go forward. But the discussion we're having right now is that we're going to, like, plow down single-family homes, build a bunch of triplexes, clog our streets, and destroy the character of our neighborhoods. That's not the way to have a discussion around affordable housing. And again, the key piece of this is the mandatory development part. This is a huge move on the part of the city of Seattle.
We have the mayor for three more minutes, I'm told. From the Northwest News Network, managing editor Phyllis Fletcher, what do you want to know?
Well, I got an email from listener Liz in South Seattle last week who was pointing out that affordable homes there have been replaced with really expensive apartments. And the fact that people want to be there is driving up the cost of all the housing, and that's the opposite of being inclusive and becoming diverse. And so I want to know how your plan addresses
that.
Sure.
So you've absolutely hit the heart of the plan. We have developed, but we have not required affordable housing in neighborhoods like that and in the Central District. So what the plan does, it requires developers, yes, you get that extra floor, but in return, you are going to be required to build affordable units. You're going to be required to participate in developing low-income units. That, along with doubling the housing levy, doing the preservation strategy I talked about, will create that diversity that we are losing in the city of Seattle. So that's the argument that we are losing. The question your reader sent you is exactly what we're talking about. That mandatory inclusionary development is how we get affordable units in the neighborhoods that are losing them today.
The mayor of Seattle will not recommend densifying all single-family zoned neighborhoods. He wants to focus on increasing affordable housing in denser urban centers, urban villages, along transit corridors. Now we move to linkage fees, getting developers of new residential projects to pay linkage fees. We move to this question of mandatory inclusionary housing, requiring developers to set aside some affordable units. So there's still a lot to do. What's going to be the next most difficult piece of getting this?
Sure. And by the way, it's commercial linkage fee on commercial development, and then it's
commercial.
It's inclusionary on residential
yes.
development. I think that the biggest discussion we're going to have now, the biggest fear, is going to be in our urban villages and in our neighborhood business districts, that somehow will destroy the character of those. And again, I would ask people to take a breath, look at the report, look at models around the country, around the world. There is a way to grow this city and to grow it intentionally to actually make it better. One of the ways you reduce traffic in this city is, I met somebody yesterday who works at Swedish. She's a nurse. Everyone she works with lives outside the city. Imagine if they could live in affordable units in the city, in a walkable or transit-friendly area. That's how you deal with some of the traffic problems as well. So I think we can do that without destroying neighborhood business districts, because that's going to be the next argument you're going to hear, is that we're going to destroy neighborhood business districts because we want to upzone them about a floor.
We're with Seattle Mayor Ed Murray. Coming up on A Week in Review, Mayor Murray, you were at the Vatican last week talking about climate change. If you had known then what Governor Inslee just ordered a cap on carbon emissions, how impressed would the Pope have been?
Of course, impressed. You know, and actually, that was a great discussion. And what was so great about the discussion is the thing we're talking about here about affordability, about people who don't make a lot, about people who are poor, and the environment are the same question. That's how the Pope has framed it. And actually what we are trying to do with inclusionary upzoning is answer that question, that you can address the issue of poverty or folks at the lower end of the economic ladder and the environment by building intentionally, by building sustainably. But that means a little more density.
We're going to talk carbon caps in a moment. Seattle Mayor Ed Murray, thank you for joining us. Back in a moment with more KUOW's Week in Review. Welcome back to KUOW's Week in Review. We are live tweeting the show right now at KUOW. This week, another Tim Iman anti-tax initiative measure qualified for the ballot. And it's already being challenged both at the Vera Project at Seattle Center We're doing a live show. And it's being challenged in court as well.
Yay.
Now, this initiative would tell the legislature, either you put a state constitutional amendment on the ballot for us, an amendment that would make it harder for you to raise taxes, or if you don't do that, the state sales tax automatically drops by a penny. Creative, right, Rob McKenna? You got to give it that.
Very creative, and born out of a lot of frustration that after the voters repeatedly enacted limits on the legislature's power to raise taxes, and only to see them overruled by the legislature or ignored by the legislature over time and then overturned by the state Supreme Court, you have this creative approach, which has issues of its own, which, of course, is why they're in court right now.
Yes, let's talk about the issues. What's the legal challenge? Why would this measure be unconstitutional?
You can't amend the Constitution by direct vote of the people. The lawsuit is arguing that this initiative effectively does that by in a sense, blackmailing the legislature into putting a constitutional amendment on the ballot, which is the way it's supposed to work. You can't amend the Constitution without the two-thirds of the legislature approving the amendment, sending it to the voters, where a majority of the voters have to approve it. This lawsuit claims that this initiative effectively is a constitutional amendment because or attempts to amend the Constitution by giving the legislature no choice. It's an argument that's likely to fail for a couple of reasons we can talk about.
Let's talk about that.
Well, first of all, the argument that the plaintiffs are making is likely to fail because on its face it is not a constitutional amendment. It is directing the legislature to choose. The two choices are accept a cut in the sales tax or send this measure to the ballot with two-thirds vote of each house. The second reason it's likely to fail is that the Supreme Court historically has been extremely reluctant to weigh in on initiatives prior to the voters having their say. They'll come in afterwards and strike down voter-approved initiatives. They've done that with some of Iman's initiatives, as a matter of fact. But typically, they wait until after the voters have voted.
Why is that? If the state Supreme Court has decided that it's unconstitutional, why don't they save us a bunch of time and just keep it off the ballot?
Well, for one thing, they're being consistent with the way they approach legislation that the legislature is considering. You don't find the Supreme Court weighing in mid-session declaring that a bill the legislature is considering is unconstitutional before the legislature has voted. The way the system of checks and balances is supposed to work is that the court acts as a check after the legislative body has acted. In this case, the voters act as the legislature, as they always do in an initiative or referendum vote.
Okay, so this might be a little wonky for the average listener. I just want to make sure if I understand it right, it's kind of like this Tim Iman initiative is trying to get the legislature, it's not a rogue constitutional amendment, it's just trying to get the legislature to help an amendment happen, the only way that can be done. But what the challengers don't like is that it seems coercive.
Right.
Right? They're not doing anything necessarily illegal, but it's like, well, you're putting so much pressure on the lawmakers. Is that, and you're saying that's not going to fly?
Well, what the sponsors would argue is number one, it isn't coercive in the sense that the legislature can make this choice, and the voters have a right to, if they pass this initiative, they have a right to reduce sales tax or an opportunity to vote on this constitutional amendment, which they've wanted. They've wanted the policy in place before. They've repeatedly enacted. The last time two-thirds requirement for legislative votes on taxes was on the ballot, majorities in over 90% of state legislative districts supported it. So it's something the voters have been pretty firm about repeatedly. So the second reason that it's not coercive, I think, you know, looking at it objectively, is that the legislature can turn around and undo the sales tax reduction immediately with their own two-thirds vote, as they can change any initiative with a two-thirds vote immediately. Or
hard to do that.
No,
but
I know,
could.
But they could. I'm just saying that's part of the checks and balances. Yeah. And within 2 years, they can undo the penny sales tax reduction by simple majority vote. So in that sense, it's not coercive. In that sense, that this is the way this is supposed to work.
Okay. We have Eli Sanders from The Stranger here. Reaction to this?
Well, you end up with something that in both directions you could argue is unconstitutional or at least is going to get the legislature in trouble with the Supreme Court. You have the idea from the plaintiffs, at least in this lawsuit, that it would be unconstitutional to blackmail the legislature into voting for a change to the Constitution. And then on the other side, yeah, you can tell those 90% of districts, by the way, this is not one of them, that supported the idea of a two-thirds majority, that, yeah, you'll get your taxes lowered through this penny decrease or whatever. But the state Supreme Court has found the state legislature in violation of the Constitution of the state of Washington for not funding education. So you start dropping the sales tax, where are you going to get the money to put the legislature in compliance with the Supreme Court's order to fund education? What this ends up being, if it goes in the direction of the sales tax decreasing, is a measure that targets fair education in this state.
But isn't that the legislature's problem, really?
Well, it's...
Now you got less money? Deal with it. That's your job, legislature.
No. The job of the legislature is to be representatives of the people. And this kind of... The initiative process, I mean, I can see benefits to it and problems in this case, but it short-circuits representative democracy. Another way that you can get a constitutional amendment is to call your legislators and get enough of them to vote for putting it on the ballot rather than running this initiative, which may or may not be constitutional.
Phyllis Fletcher, managing editor of the Northwest News Network, you've got a reporter on this. What are you looking into in this story?
Well, I wanted to find out, like, you know, kind of like what Rob was talking about, if there was a precedent for something being taken off the ballot preemptively, and we didn't find that, but has that happened?
There's only one initiative I can think of where that happened. It involved an initiative that was blocked before, it might have even been before signature gathering commenced. It had to do with an attempt to amend federal law. And there the state Supreme Court weighed in and said, nah, you can't do that. And,
okay.
And that was so obvious that there they did take action. But it just highlights how rare it is for them to try to stop an initiative before it actually gets to the ballot.
Yeah.
Okay, so if this actually gets to the ballot, how should I vote? Just tell me what to do.
I think we've got I favor the two-thirds requirement. I favor the two-thirds requirement bill. Friends of mine who are Republicans, like Sam Reed and Dan Evans and others, are opposed to it because they're frustrated with the ability of one-third of a legislative body stopping what a majority wants to do. That's their argument.
This is setting that bar so high, a supermajority bar to get taxes
raised. Sam Reed emailed me and said, look, in the U.S. Senate, very little is happening, because in the U.S. Senate it takes 60% to do anything. So he's making a conservative argument that our framers wanted majority rule, not supermajority rule. The counterargument is that voters, this is, after all, our country and our government, and the voters have repeatedly said we want stronger fiscal restraints because they've seen the legislature over time steadily raise taxes. So that's the counterargument. So what's more important, the constitutional principle or what the voters have repeatedly expressed as their desire?
He won't just tell me what to do. He's flexible Republican Rob McKenna.
Make up your own mind, Bill.
Phyllis Fletcher, I know you get to recuse yourself on this question. So, Eli Sanders, how do we vote?
We keep talking about what the voters have said they want. The voters say they want lower taxes and better roads and perfect schools. It makes no sense. There's a cognitive dissonance in the body politic when you look at it. So if you just run by what the voters are saying, you can't run a state. You should vote. If you're asking me which way to vote, first of all, I hope this thing doesn't get on the ballot, but if it does, vote against it. It is not going to improve roads or schools, and it's definitely not going to improve the functioning of the legislature.
The best argument in favor of it, Bill, is that even if this penny sales tax cut took effect, there would still be more money in the state budget in the next biennium than there was in the last biennium, because revenues grew faster than that. And the second argument in favor of it would be, to Eli's point, would be that, yeah, people want good roads and they want good schools. But the fact is, it's also a matter of priorities, and the legislature is supposed to fund education first, which, frankly, they weren't doing for a long time.
Okay, we're going to have plenty of time to debate this some more, maybe. We'll see what the state Supreme Court says. We've been talking about Initiative 1366, Tim Eisenbach initiative, requiring the state legislature to put a constitutional amendment on the ballot, making it harder to raise taxes, or else your sales tax drops by a penny, coming to your November ballot unless the state Supreme Court blocks it. On KUOW's Week in Review, we're going to come back in a moment. Let's face it, Portland is more gangster than we are. Stay tuned. KUOW's Week in Review. We've got a lot happening this week, and we want to discuss it, debate it, and make you smarter because of it. So let's talk about Shell Oil, okay? The The last I heard, actually, maybe you guys have heard an update since. My understanding is that there were 13 demonstrators in Portland hanging off the St. John's Bridge, blocking this Shell Oil icebreaker from heading out to go to Alaska. The icebreaker got through because it turns out to let the icebreaker through, you don't have to remove all of those dangling protesters. You just need to remove three of them. Give that icebreaker a little space. So finally, after something like a 40-hour standoff, this icebreaker has moved on and headed out to help our Polar Pioneer, which we didn't keep in Elliott Bay, to help the Polar Pioneer drill in the Chukchi Sea off North Alaska. So Jennifer Delohi, is an energy reporter with the Houston Chronicle. Jennifer, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
We want to find out, first of all, why was this icebreaker in Portland getting repaired? It had some kind of gash to it, but what, we don't fix boats in Washington State? Why was this icebreaker in Portland?
Well, the icebreaker actually staged in Portland before the accident occurred, before it had this gash in its hull. And so it actually made a little bit of sense. So while the Polar Pioneer was in Seattle, the Seneca, this icebreaker, was in Portland. That's, you know, a couple months ago. And after the accident, after the gash was discovered, Arctia, the owner of the vessel, and Shell had people come out from Vigor Industrial to take a look at the boat in Alaska, and they essentially picked that location largely because those folks were familiar with the ship.
Okay, as we know, we went through something like this in Seattle many weeks ago with Shell's drilling rig, the Polar Pioneer, when it docked in Elliott Bay at the mouth of the Duwamish. What is the relationship between that oil rig and this icebreaker?
Right, so there are actually two oil rigs that are working for Shell in the Arctic Ocean, and the Polar Pioneer, as you noted, is one of them. But beyond that, there are more than two dozen support vessels that keep, you know, the ship supplied, provide oil spill response in case of an emergency, and provide other critical support. The Seneca, the icebreaker, is particularly essential. Not only does it work to move ice out of the way and keep the area clear of icebergs as much as possible, it also holds critical emergency equipment that would be called to bear if there were a blown-out well, like the Macondo, BP's failed Macondo well in the Gulf of Mexico.
Okay, so why, you know, our flotilla of kayaktivists didn't keep the Polar Pioneer in Elliott Bay long. There was a 40-hour delay in Portland. Why does it matter how long it takes for this icebreaker to get to Alaska, or does it matter?
Well, it does matter. This brief delay is not so long that it's going to critically alter operations for Shell in the Arctic Ocean. However, the Seneca is so essential to what they're doing out there that federal regulators have said, you know, unless this emergency equipment and the Seneca used to deploy it are on the scene, we're not going to let you, Shell, drill very deep toward oil and gas-bearing zones, potential oil and gas-bearing zones. So they're forcing regulators, the Obama administration right now is forcing Shell to stop thousands of feet before the oil and gas that they want to get to. If they get the Seneca on site pretty swiftly, they can go back, Shell can go back to the regulators at the Interior Department and ask for renewed, revised permits to drill deeper. And, that process and those talks are underway now.
Okay, so bottom line, after all the protesting and all the attempts at delay, because the water's going to freeze again someday, maybe, it's 90 degrees right now in Seattle, how much work is Shell able to get done in this little window in the Chukchi Sea?
Yeah, so they have to stop by September 28th, and let's assume that they get those permits to go deeper. They're still really only going to be able to get work done on one well, and the timeline right now does not look like they're going to be able to finish. They started drilling yesterday by excavating a big hole in the ground to put some emergency equipment below the seafloor to shelter it from passing icebergs. So they started that yesterday. The problem is for Shell, they need about 68 days, they think, to drill this well, and they basically have 61 days before regulators say, the ice is coming, you need to get out of here. So likely they get pretty far into this well, but temporarily abandon it and have to come back next year. And, of course, their original plans were to drill two wells, and they're being barred from doing that because of some wildlife protection.
So Shell might be running out of time. Final question, then. How much credit can the protesters of Seattle and Portland take for that fact?
Well, I hate to dash their hopes. They can't take too much credit for delaying the Seneca and delaying the operations, or the fact that Shell probably won't get to the bottom of this well. The Seneca's the accident initially with the Seneca may have more to do with that. Again, though, they keep pressure on this issue, they keep attention on this issue, and I think regulators have said that the public awareness is, they're very aware of the opposition, the level of attention, and the public awareness around this.
Jennifer DeLohey is an energy reporter for the Houston Chronicle. You know so much. Thank you, Jennifer, for wisening us up.
Thank you.
Okay, so back with our panel on the Week in Review. Remember when pro-business types called the Elliott Bay kayaktivist protest silly and useless and purely symbolic? How does that look today when Shell is, running out of time? Every day seems to count.
I think you just heard why it's useful. It gets the attention of regulators. It gets the attention of policymakers. It maybe, in some small way does delay Shell. The activists in Portland delayed the Seneca, the icebreaker ship, by a day. So, I don't know, that's something. But I think the bigger victory is getting attention to this and also getting people engaged with the idea that there are ways to act to stop climate change.
Did anyone else, did any part of you, when you found out that Polar Pioneer got in and out of here just fine and Portland rappelled off bridges, did any part of you go, Portland?
Oh, we did. Yes, and we did a poll about this on Slog, the Stranger's
really?
Blog.
Oh.
Yeah, why? What does it mean that Portland was able to stop a Shell ship and Seattle wasn't?
Thank you.
And the biggest answer was nothing. Portland has a narrow river and a bridge. We have this, big sound. It's a little harder geographically. So don't get cocky, Portland.
Don't get cocky, Portland. That little, there's a little competition there, right?
I heard that the kayaktivists were starting to refer to the folks in Portland as Portland pinatas for hanging off the bridge. So that's a vicious rumor. But the Seneca crew is probably just slightly disappointed that they were removed. I don't know.
I wanted to ask if you guys remember something, and maybe this is, I don't know if this is a sign of change or not, but there was a similar action in Seattle in 1997 to try to block fishing trawlers, and they did delay two of them by a couple days. It was Greenpeace activists hanging from the Aurora Bridge. You guys, I hear an, oh yeah, yeah. And actually one of them, one of the gentlemen who did that, Garfield Bulldog, by the way, he was indicted in the FBI's Operation Backfire in 2006 and is believed to have fled to Syria.
That's a good choice.
Well, he'll
be hanging from a bridge there before long.
Wow. He's of Syrian descent. So
oh, okay. Well,
there was a reason, yeah. You got some hisses there, Rob.
Oh, come on.
Right, this guy. it made me think about, is that something that would happen today? I mean, this gentleman and other people who were involved in that were also high tech. They were software engineers. Unknown to me at the time, I worked with some of them while they were doing this. And I don't know if that's still an element of Seattle that exists now among like the high tech. Are we that same Seattle in as we were in 97?
Right. It was like, it was this little gut check, I mean, I know, was it just about the fact that it was a bridge and all that? Or was there something? I feel like in the air, I heard people questioning whether Portland's got more fire in the belly. We're a little successful, a little fat and happy.
I do think if you count the number of kayaktivists that we had in Seattle over many, many days, it actually probably outnumbers, and this is not just Seattle Pride speaking, like looking at the pictures, I think we had more kayaktivists here on the water than Portland did.
Yeah.
It's just the logistical hassle of trying to, close off the entire south end of Puget Sound. Also, maybe the Coast Guard here in Seattle was a little more proactive in breaking up the line that people tried to draw across the mouth of the Duwamish. The Portland police and the Coast Guard there, I don't think they really knew what to do at first with these people hanging from a bridge. And also, it's a little bit easier to get in your boat and kind of bump a kayak out of the way than it is to, rappel down, which the police in Portland eventually had to do, rappel down from a bridge and dangle there with the activists and cut some of their lines and bring them down.
In the military...
in a campaign, you adapt your tactics to the terrain, and I think that's what the Portland protesters did. Ah. But what they have in common with the activists is that it was a brilliant bit of political theater to draw attention to their cause. And you have to give them a lot of credit for coming up with a creative way to do that, which was very effective.
Mm. And courageous. I mean, they will face, I don't know if it's jail time, but they at least are going to be going to court. They've all been charged with, I don't know, criminal trespass or something. So they did this knowing that there would be serious legal consequences for themselves.
Don't hate on me, Kai activists. I'm just getting at the human, the behavioral psychology that I've heard around is
what really,
something about siblings.
What's really irritating about it is that this will show up as a Portlandia episode next season. And it just kills me. Kills me.
Okay, so the news is that the icebreaker Fenica is headed to Alaska, but Shell Oil is down to the wire, not able to do what they even hoped to do in the beginning, and only playing with a matter of days to even get anything much done at all, and even a shallow well in Alaska. You're listening to KUOW's Week in Review. Cap on carbon. No cap on the amount of money that a Seattle Seahawk quarterback can make, apparently. And maybe a cap on how much H2O you will use this summer. Stay tuned. Stay tuned, because this is KUOW's Week in Review. We're with a live audience at the Vera Project at Seattle Center. District 7, last stop on our summer tour. You know, KUOW has been visiting every one of Seattle's new election districts. We're voting for city council members district by district, as well as citywide this time. That hasn't happened in 100 years or so. And so we're in every district. We're in the district that is composed of downtown and Queen Anne and Magnolia and South Lake Union, too, right? And what's that?
Belltown.
And Belltown. Nicely done. You must have gone to KUOW.org/elections. And we're getting to better know a district. We've got Rob McKenna, Eli Sanders, Phyllis Fletcher, and this week Governor Jay Inslee, who campaigned promising to fight climate change and didn't get anything through the legislature, took an alternate route. He's using his executive authority to direct the Department of Ecology to put a cap on carbon emissions. Eli, how much does this do for the environment? Do we know yet?
No. I think we find out when ecology comes back and tells us what it can do to put the cap on carbon emissions. But as you said, this all arises because the legislature wouldn't act, and in particular the state Senate blocked Inslee's efforts to create a cap-and-trade system that would have reduced carbon emissions and, by the way, would have brought in billions, potentially, for schools, for roads, or for transit, for things that the state could use money to improve. But anyway, this Republicans in the state legislature blocked that, and not only did they block it, they had a poison pill inserted into the budget so that if Governor Inslee tried to do anything on cap and trade outside of the legislative process.
Clean fuel, if he tried to require clean burning fuel.
Right, sorry.
Yeah.
Clean fuel, then they would take money away from transit.
Right.
So he's kind of hemmed in here, and this is something he can do. He can order the Department of Ecology to come up with rules, because that's what ecology does, and we'll see what they can come up with.
So you say Governor Inslee ran up against Republicans, but Rob McKenna, he didn't even get much of his environmental agenda through his own Democrats in the House.
Yeah, the carbon tax not only did not pass the House, it was not brought up for a vote in the House, and that's the chamber that his party controls. So it's of course, his move is to criticize the Senate, but it didn't show a lot of legislative power to get it through the House, for that matter. And I think the Speaker of the House saw that it wasn't going to be a popular measure in his own chamber, and he didn't want his members taking the political hit for voting on it. So the fact of the matter is none of it got through the House or the Senate. And now, you know, he's doing what he's allowed to do, which is to ask the Department of Ecology to enact by regulation those measures to reduce emissions that they can enact by regulation. The question is, what are those measures? And that remains to be seen. The debate over low-carbon fuel standards the fuel mandate that he was suggesting, is really a debate about executive power versus legislative power. And you know, a lot of us think that low carbon fuel standards require legislative enactment, as they did in California, where they were enacted and are now the law, and cannot be enacted by regulation or by executive order. So we'll see what the Department of Ecology comes up with, and then you know we'll see what that how that fits in that framework of checks and balances.
So tell me, guy who ran against Jay Inslee for governor, how would you grade the governor's performance on one of his pet issues?
Well, look, you know, objectively, because I'm certainly not objective in some ways, but objectively, he just was not able to get his major initiatives through the House or even get them up for a vote in the House to then force the Senate to either vote them up or down. That didn't happen. And it seems like Frank Chop is deciding, as the Speaker of the House, deciding what he wants to do without that much regard for what the governor's agenda is.
This comes up a lot when you talk about what Inslee accomplished and didn't accomplish in the legislative session. And you say, well, the Senate would not have passed this measure, and Republicans come back and say, well, the House didn't even put it up for a vote. It did go through a committee process in the House, and I believe it passed out of a committee there. And to say that the House, even that it's democratically controlled and it didn't vote for this Inslee measure, therefore it's a rebuke of Inslee, it's kind of like saying that a bunch of people who are related to you decided not to drive into a brick wall, therefore that's embarrassing for you. Like, there was nowhere to go with this bill passing out of the House. The Senate and the Republicans there had already said that they were going to block it. And so I think the calculation was made to get a budget done and get a budget through and get something passed that Senate that could actually be voted on and move forward that way.
It's called pragmatism, McKenna, not running into a wall.
Typically, though, you pass what you think is the right policy, you send it over to the other chamber, then you negotiate and you get as much of it as you can. Here, and that's the way that most bills work, the House doesn't wait to see what the Senate's going to do before it passes bills. It passes lots of bills that don't survive in the Senate, and the same happens in reverse, since bills can also originate in the Senate. Here, it's pretty clear to me that the Speaker didn't want some of his own members to have to vote on this unless he had some sort of guarantee it was going to pass in the Senate. And that's a measure of politics, perhaps pragmatic politics, but politics nonetheless.
So Governor Inslee did not get it through the legislature, but he's using his executive authority to tell the Ecology Department to put some kind of cap on carbon emissions, and we're all agreeing that mostly what we have now is question marks. We're waiting to see what the Ecology Department is going to do and can do. So that's what's happening with climate change in Washington State. Coming up on the Week in Review, Russell Wilson and your lawn. Stay with us. We're on Twitter, at KUOW, and on the radio, we are covering the top stories of the week for you in just 1 hour on the Week in Review. And this week, the most beloved athlete in Seattle. Anybody want to debate me on that? We'll get to that. Seahawks quarterback Russell Wilson is staying in Seattle. This just broke. He agreed to stay in Seattle for at least the next 5 seasons. This is a contract extension, biggest in the Seahawks history by far. Seems like good news. He's a terrific quarterback. But every dollar the Seahawks pay him is a dollar they can't pay the other players. And this was like an $87 million deal. So I'm not the biggest football aficionado. Percy Allen, you cover the Seahawks for the Seattle Times. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So modest. He's telling him, stop. How should I feel? Is this good news or bad news?
Well, I think we can...
paying Russell Wilson a lot to stay.
I think we can just all breathe easier now. Basically, this is something that we talked about for the past 3 months or 4 months, and is he going to stay? Is he not going to stay? I think we all kind of knew that he was going to stay. It was just a matter of what was that number going to be. And so now that we have it, and practice started about 25 minutes ago, and he's out there, and he ran out to the field, and he looks perfectly fine. And so... yeah, so the Seahawks will have their quarterback now for the next 4 or 5 years.
Did we pay him too much?
Well, that's a matter to be debated.
Yeah, that's what we're doing right now.
Well, all right. Okay. Well, right now, no, because you had to have him, you know. So, and it's a matter of guys that are this good demand a certain salary. You know, like yourself. Like, I'm sure that you get paid big bucks.
A lot. Yes.
So, you
and
know.
That comes out of Phyllis Fletcher's salary.
Yes.
This is what I'm saying. We have to make choices in life.
So if I'm asking Phyllis if you're paid too much, you know, that'd probably be it. So did we pay him too much? I don't think so. He is the second highest paid player in the NFL behind Aaron Rodgers of the Green Bay Packers. But that's not going to last long. I mean, just the one thing about the NFL is that these things are very fluid. There's a quarterback in Indianapolis by the name of Andrew Luck who's going to sign a contract that's going to blow this away. So, you know, I mean, right now it seems like a lot of money, but Paul Allen, trust me, I think he can afford it.
Okay. So you cover the Seahawks. You know Russell Wilson, at least professionally. You've spent a lot of time
yes.
with him. How do you feel about Russell Wilson?
How do I feel about him?
Because because there's not every athlete is as some are likable, some are not. Some are overrated, some are not.
So if you don't want to answer that question, we talk about Sienna for a few minutes.
Yes.
Sierra. You were close.
We'll get to that.
How do I feel about, you know?
And him being here in Seattle.
Well, I will say this. Sitting next to somebody who ran for office, he does have a politician type of a feel to him that, I think he comes across as a very nice guy. You know, you ask him a question, he will answer it. And he'll talk for a long time, and then you sort of look up at your notes, and you look, and he didn't really say a whole lot.
Yeah, politician. Right, Rob?
Warms my heart.
Oh, stop it, Rob. You know, so I don't know what school you guys go to. I don't know how that happens. But and it is a great tool because he smiles and he looks so good and he's just saying these words and really nice words are coming out of his mouth. And then after a while, you're like, I didn't really learn anything. But now that being said, he's a nice representative of Seattle, of the Seahawks. I don't think he's someone that we're going to see getting trouble, you know, anything like that.
Not like Tom Brady at the Patriots, who just got suspended for deflating footballs. Unlike Tom Brady, Russell Wilson is not a thug.
You know, but, you know, like Tom Brady, though, he has sort of chosen now to go into the celebrity mode. You know, like he is becoming a celebrity quarterback. And so, you know, now personally.
So talk to us about Ciara versus Giselle.
Oh, wow.
there's a debate worth having.
Now, everybody doesn't even know who Ciara is. Tell us about, there's this side to Russell Wilson that he's
speaking.
He's getting famous.
Well, yes. And that's one of the.
Fancy.
For, you know, for me. And for what I do, that's one of the neat things is to kind of see these kids grow up. You know, this was a guy who was drafted by the Seahawks 3 years ago in 2012 in the third round. And, you know, at the time he was married, you know. He married his college sweetheart, but they divorced. I don't know what happened there, but they
yes, you do.
Divorced. I have no clue.
You know, give it up.
Politician. That's so political.
You know, and since then he's gone to two Super Bowls and he has really put himself on this fast track to be a celebrity. And so now he's dating really beautiful people. And so his girlfriend now is a singer by the name of Sierra, who they seem to be. They are a beautiful couple. I mean, my goodness. And if they ever have kids, they're going to be
anyone who can
kids.
Make the Obamas look homely has got something going for them. I mean, they were stunning at the White House.
Yes, they were. Yeah. So he has entered that, and it is kind of neat, you know, to just kind of see this kid kind of grow up and to see where he's going to go with all of this.
Yeah. Instead of importing a famous player from someplace else, he's come up here, and that's been kind of nice. Okay.
Now, the flip side of that is that, you know, he could be our A-Rod. Now,
yes!
You know, and I know, and we've had conversations about this, but people sort of have their opinion of Alex now, but we forget that when Alex was here, you know, here, and he was young, he was so fresh, and he was a baby, and he was good-looking, and, you know, hey, people change, and we'll see what happens to Russell.
Yeah, so he's Mr. Perfect, Dudley Do-Right, but he's dating super celebrities and making gazillions now. So
and again,
which
there's
way?
Nothing wrong with that.
Not saying there's anything wrong with that. No. Okay, we're just about to go. So let me just catch you up on one last story this week. Seattle just moved to the water advisory stage, okay? You need to know there are four levels: advisory, voluntary, mandatory, and emergency. We just got to stage one, even though we had a crazy low snowpack and then a hot, dry summer. Months ago, water managers told us we have plenty of rainwater in the reservoir, act normally. And I asked, really, shouldn't we conserve water just in case? Nope, water supply is good. Then a few weeks ago, they announced our water supply has been downgraded from good to only fair. So we had a Seattle Public Utilities spokesperson on this show, and I said, so now you're telling us to conserve water? And she said, no. I said, can my kids run through the sprinkler? She said, well, no, don't do that. I said, so you are telling me to conserve water? And she said, no, that would be voluntary conservation. That's stage two. I said, so you're asking me to conserve water? She said, no, that would be an advisory. That's stage one. So I said, well, what are you saying? And she said, well, we're just asking you not to waste water. And I said, maybe you should ask me to conserve water just in case, because when it's hot and dry, the rain's not watering your yard or washing your car, and your kids want to play in sprinklers, so you know people will use an above-average amount of water. Well, this week, local cities finally announced a stage one advisory, and a Bellevue utility spokesman said, quote, I don't think we've ever had a historically hot June and July, and then pair that with people using an above-average amount of water. Who could have guessed? So again, you're not being told to voluntarily reduce your water use. That would be stage two. You're only being advised that you might one day be told to voluntarily conserve water. Got it?
Okay.
Everybody's lawn's brown?
I'm confused.
Rats!
I'm convinced you're a water use prophet now. What's coming next?
In the 80s in Finning Ridge, there was someone who dug up their lawn, filled it in with cement, and painted it green. I want to do that. It's cool.
Someone told us on Facebook, don't call it brown. Don't call your yarn brown. Call it golden.
Aww.
This is the Week in Review. Percy Allen from the Seattle Times, thanks for stopping by.
Thank you.
Thank you to Phyllis Fletcher from Northwest News Network, Eli Sanders from The Stranger, Rob McKenna, former state attorney general. Jennifer Dooley stopped by. Seattle's mayor was here on the show. And thank you to Seattle Channel for taping this show. Thank you, Caroline and Timmy, the folks who set this stuff up. Jason Pergano produces the show. And District 7 Seattle Center, it's been so great to be with you. Thank you so much. See you soon.